Thank you, Gary. Appreciate that. And good evening to you all. Welcome you to the house of the Lord. See, my sermon here is connecting the dots. You know, so many times we can look at a single point of either in a story or a verse of scripture or a single incident in someone's life or in your own life, and, you know, it doesn't always make sense how we got there, you know, because context matters, you know, the whole picture kind of matters. Any single point will often on its own not make a whole lot of sense. So when you read the scriptures, you really kind of need to understand, you know, what's the context, who is the audience, you know, who's being spoken to, what's being spoken about, what are the things that were surrounding that. In order to get, you know, the whole picture, you know, you have to connect all the dots. You know, this is one of the things that many people who challenge Christianity, that's what they'll do, is they'll challenge something. They'll be like, hey, God endorses this. God let Israel get away with that. It happened here. It happened there. And they're picking out a single point. And they're saying, look, you know, Christianity is such and such or whatever. You know, they don't connect all the dots. You know, they don't take the time to put it all together. So you have to take the time to put things together and connect all the dots. You know, I was in school. As a young kid, they would hand out assignments, you know, and it was like an art assignment, and you had to connect the dots on a piece of paper. And some of those were really easy. You could look at the picture and you could see exactly what it was, you know, and so just kind of getting used to for you to draw. But as you get a little bit older, your skill level has to get tested and increased. They would, you know, give you a lot more dots, and then you couldn't tell what it was until maybe you got most of the way through. You know, that's the way it can be for us too. Sometimes it's simple. We can look at something and be like, and see the dots, and be like, all right, I see what that is, even without having to take the time to draw it out. And other times, it takes a long time. It might take a whole lifetime or years to figure out, you know, what am I drawing? What's becoming here? So I have a little example here of, there you are, there's a bunch of dots. And, you know, it's kind of hard to tell what that is if you just look at the dots. You can't really make too much out of it. I mean, you connect those dots in any number of ways, but if you connect them or connect them in the right way, you actually, you know, you get something, right? Get a little fish. So if you connect those dots appropriately, and that's what I'm hoping we'll do tonight, is connect some of these dots appropriately. You know, like I spoke about, our life is, you know, a series of events, a series of dots, if you will, and it's really what makes us what we are. You know, what is a human? You know, it's flesh and bone. That's the physical side of it. And then there's a soul. That's the spiritual side of it. You know, but what makes us who we are? What makes us unique? You know, it's the things that happen to us, the experiences we have. They're beyond, you know, flesh and bone and things that, you know, speak to our spirit or things that we have in our memory. That's really what makes us who we are. And so when we're going through life, and we get to a low point or a high point, and reflecting back, are you looking on someone else? Are you looking on, you know, how did they get here? Where is this taking me? Those are two very important questions that we need to ask ourselves. We can't just look at a single point, either of success or failure, and make a judgment. You gotta kind of connect those dots. How do we get here? If it's a success, how did I get here? You know, what are the things that I did right to get me here? How can I repeat that? If it's a failure, you know, how did I get here? What are the things I did so that I don't come back here? You know, sometimes we don't know the answers right away. Sometimes we're just going through things that are not of our own doing. There's just life, and life happens. And we may not be able to understand in the moment, but it's an important question, you know, where is this taking me? You know, what is this preparing me for? So we are truly just the sum total of our experiences, you know, beyond flesh and bone and beyond soul. That's really what it comes down to, is the things that we experience. The dots that are in our lives, those points that we can all look back and we can think of times, you know, happy times and sad times, little dots, you know, and they all connect to make, you know, us and who we are. And so we're talking about mostly about David this evening. And King David in the Old Testament, in Samuel, 1 and 2 Samuel, and in Kings, and of course in Psalms, you know, King David, that king. He had, you know, some high points in his life. And the First one we're going to talk about, of course, is the one that everybody knows, right? 1 Samuel, in the 17th chapter, verse 48. David has, he's a young boy, and he has, at this point, been visited by a prophet and been anointed. And after he was anointed, there was this battle that took place in that, or an invasion of the Philistines. And David went to deliver food and supplies to his brothers. And, of course, he sees what's taking place. For a lot of days, there was a champion of the Philistines, Goliath. He came out, and he was challenging the armies of Israel. And everyone was afraid because of this man's size. He was very big. And he would come out and challenge them, and they would retreat. And they did this over and over again. Extend your best. Send someone out. And history refers to this as single combat. You know, it was actually quite common in ancient history where either some generals or champions would come out and they would do battle with each other on behest of their army. And it was either A, to resolve the issue, or B, to give their side, you know, morale boost. If you won, then everyone became happy about that on your side. And so that's kind of what the purpose of this was to either, you know, resolve the issue without a lot of bloodshed or to raise the morale on your side. So it was quite common throughout history to see single combat. Warriors would go out, challenge each other before a battle. And so that's what's taking place, is Goliath is going out and he's challenging, offering combat to Israel's champion. And they all are afraid and they all flee. So here in 1 Samuel, the 17th chapter, the 48th verse, and it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew nigh to meet David, David hasted and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took thence a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in his forehead, that the stone sank into his forehead and he fell upon his face to the earth. So David went out and he met this champion and slew him in front of these two armies. And if you read down a little farther, verse 52, this raised the morale of Israel. And the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines until they came to the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the wounded of the Philistines fell down by the way of Shaarim, even to Gath and unto Ekron. So it raised the morale of the Israelite army to see the Philistine champion fall, and they began to pursue it. It turned the invasion away. You know, this is a high point. You know, a big moment in David's life, and where he came out and he did as he defended his God and defended his country from those that were cursing the army, cursing his God. They're threatening their existence and their well-being and their way of life. And he saved his people, saved his army by his actions, you know. And so we would ask, you know, one of the questions is, how did he get there? Did he start off at the top when everything was on the line? Did he all start off when everything was important and everything mattered? Well, if you read earlier, he gives his explanation to the king. 1 Samuel 17, 34, and David said unto Saul, thy servant kept his father's sheep. And there came a lion and a bear, and took a lamb out of the flock. And now we look at this. This is where he got his training. He got his bravery and his courage. And it wasn't when he was standing in front of an army. It wasn't when his own country was under threat. It wasn't when his family was going to be threatened. They took a lamb. That's it. One lamb. And what is David's response? And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be as one of them, seeing he hath defied the armies of the living God. You know, going back to that area of responsibility, he was responsible for a flock of sheep for his family. And they took one lamb. You know, one lamb in the history of Israel doesn't mean anything. Nothing at all. His family, it would not have devastated his family if he'd lost that lamb. Wouldn't have devastated his flock. No one would have turned an eye or probably berated him very much if he lost that lamb. But something was inside David. He had a sense of duty. You know, I've been given responsibility over this flock. And if it is torn away by bears and lions, the wildlife are able to come and feed, you know, that's going to present a problem. And then eventually, you know, yeah, that's going to affect my family. You know, still wouldn't affect the house of Israel, one flock of sheep being destroyed. You know, the country would still go. It would have affected his family. I imagine they would have found a way around. But still, he took responsibility. When the nation was not at stake, when really nothing was at stake. But he was developing this kingship. He was developing this courage. He was developing his bravery and his skills when very little was on the line. And so when very little was on the line, he was practiced in what his response would be, so that when everything was on the line, this was who he was, who he became in the fields where the lambs were. This is how he was able to step onto the battlefield, take responsibility for his people, for his nation, for his fellow soldiers that were out there, because he learned how to be responsible. He learned how to make the brave decision when nothing was on the line, so that when everything was on the line, it was no decision at all. It's just who he was. That's how he got there. That's how he got to that high point in his life. Oh, I forgot a verse there. You know, this is what he knew by doing that. Verse 37, David said, "Moreover, the Lord that delivered me out of the paw of the lion, out of the paw of the bear, he will deliver me out of the hand of this Philistine." And Saul said unto David, "Go, and the Lord be with thee." He knew. He tested the Lord early on. And the Lord was with him early on. So he had a faith that became a knowledge. I know God's hand rests upon me. He will protect me. So once again, when the nation is at stake, my countrymen are at stake, it's who he was. The decision was then easy. It's who he was. He had high points, of course. You read in through here. He also had some low points. You know, after this battle has taken place, he is honored. He is given a place in Saul's court. He is treated quite nicely to begin with. And when they get back to civilization after this army has been defeated, they begin to sing praises of David. They speak of how he slayed his thousands, I believe it was. And then the king began to notice this and notice that, hey, there was this powerful person. And way back in ancient times, that's a lot of times how kingship was made, is that you went out and you performed. You went out and you did great feats of bravery and courage, and you fought. You showed your prowess on the battlefield, and that's how, and people would believe in you. This is someone I can get behind, someone who can take care of us when evil comes. Then Saul heard these songs of praise to David, and jealousy began to creep in. And then it wasn't for too long when that jealousy grew and grew, and he then began to pursue David and try to kill him. And so David has to flee. And we find in 1 Samuel, the 22nd chapter, first verse, "David therefore departed thence and escaped to the cave of Adullam. And when his brethren and his father's house heard it, they went down thither to him." So he leaves. And Saul is pursuing him, trying to murder him because of who he is, what he's become, of no doing of his own. He didn't ask the people of Israel to sing his praises. He didn't seek this on his own. It was something that was out of his control. He was just doing what he was supposed to do. And here he's being pursued because of jealousy. So his family hears about it. They come visit him. And he gets some other people to come with him too. Verse 2, "And everyone that was in distress, and everyone that was in debt, and everyone that was discontented, gathered themselves unto him. And he became a captain over them. And there were with him about 400 men." So his family's there, and some other people come. You know, this is not the people that you would think you'd want by your side when you're being chased and someone's trying to murder you. Those that are in distress. Those that are in debt, they have nothing. No money to add to your cause. Those that are discontented, those that are unhappy. If you imagine you're in the worst time of your life, you're being pursued, chased, having to live in caves, and these are the people that come to support you. Doesn't sound like a lot of fun, does it? Some of you might work in a place like this. Distressed, debt, discontented. You know, it's not fun being around these types of people. But these are the ones that sought him out. These are the ones that gathered around him. Said, hey, we want you to lead us. So what does David do? Well, he turns to the Lord. And so the Lord sends a prophet. Verse 5, and the prophet Gad said unto David, abide not in the hold, depart, and get thee into the land of Judah. Then David departed and came to the forest of Hereth. And so he listens to the Lord. Lord, he asks the Lord. He sings psalms to the Lord. He's thinking about what he needs to do, where he should go. And the Lord answers him and tells him, gives him direction. Here's where you need to go. Keeps him alive. And in that moment, it might be kind of hard to think, why am I here? What is this for? But God could see. He was preparing him for his kingship. And you ask, where did it take him? You look in 2 Samuel, the 21st chapter, again in the first verse. Then there was a famine in the days of David, 3 years, year after year. And David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered, it is for Saul and for his bloody house, because he slew the Gibeonites. Now, we have to back up and talk a little bit here. By this point in time, David has the throne. He is king. Saul has committed suicide on the battlefield. He is long gone. But there comes this famine. And when David asks, hey, why are we suffering, Lord? What's going on? And the Lord tells him, well, there was this transgression by the previous king. Again, something that David didn't cause, didn't ask for. His people are suffering from something that he didn't do, just like he was back in that cave. These suffering people were surrounding him because of something that he didn't do. And so the Gibeonites, if you go back, they were a people. Actually, look in verse 2 here. And the king called in the Gibeonites and said to them, now, the Gibeonites were not of the children of Israel, but of the remnant of the Amorites. And the children of Israel had sworn unto them. And Saul sought to slay them in his zeal to the children of Israel and Judah. So we get this little bit of an explanation. So you have to go back 400 years in time to when Joshua had come. And when Joshua got to the land of Israel, they were beset by all these people that were already there, because Israel's coming in. They're going to take this land. God has given it to them, the promised land. And they had to go in and they had to fight. And all these tribes that were there gathered together and banded against Israel, and they began to work against them. Well, this little group of Amorites, they made a deal with Joshua. They said, hey, we're not going to fight against you. And so God honored that deal. Joshua honored that deal. And Israel honored that deal for 400 years. You can continue to live here with us. We won't kick you out. We won't subject you to what God has subjected your other tribes around you. You can stay. And so for 400 years, this deal remained. And then Saul got to the scene. And Saul, he began to lose his grip on power. And like many leaders do, when they start to lose their grip or they start to get questioned, they find a scapegoat. They find a group of people. Like, hey, those guys over there, that's your problem. So they're not focused no longer on the king. They're not focused on this external threat, these different people over here who are not of the house of Israel. These are your problem. And so Saul goes in and he makes war against them and slays them unjustifiably. He goes and he breaks the truce. And because that truce was broken, this famine propped up. So David's got to do something. Now, so he goes to the Lord. Now he's got to solve a problem that he didn't cause. Was not of his doing. And he does just that. Verse 3, wherefore David said unto the Gibeonites, what shall I do for you? And wherewith shall I make the atonement, that ye may bless the inheritance of the Lord? So he had to go to them, and he had to ask them, hey, how can I make this right? And they make a request of him. They request, actually, Saul's children. And they actually take Saul's children prisoner. I think they actually hung him on a wall. It's kind of a gruesome story. But it was made right again. And it was restored. Again, David didn't do it. But how did he know how to do this? He had to rely on the Lord. He had to solve a problem that was not of his doing. Because he'd had practice. You know, when he had nothing, when he was just in charge of sheep, when he was in charge of debtors and distressed and discontented, he had nothing. He was formed. He made decisions when he had nothing, when he had no one that could help him. He relied on the Lord and made these decisions and formed who he was going to be and how he was going to lead. We find in Luke in the 16th chapter, in the words of Christ, verse 10, he that is faithful in that which is least is faithful also in much. And he that is unjust in the least is unjust also in much. If therefore you have not been faithful in the unrighteous mammon, who will commit to your trust the true riches? If you have not been faithful in that which is another man's, who shall give you that which is your own? And that's what Christ is saying here. It's like, you know, the little things matter. The decisions that we make when not much is on the line, when no one's going to know. Those decisions that we make in secret, or when, you know, there's not going to be any real cost. Those decisions matter. They reflect your character and who you are. And you have to have a guide. You have to have something that will get you through, not only in the small things, but in the big things. You know, I went to the police academy, and, you know, the whole police academy is years ago now. It's a test. They put you in charge of small things. When I first got to the police academy, I was issued a pen. Black ballpoint pen. And I was put in charge of a pen, and I had to take care of that pen. And if I didn't show up with my pen, I had to write a memo and I had to go run trails, do discipline, because I hadn't taken care of my pen. You know, the pen doesn't matter. It's nothing. If I lost 10 pens, it wouldn't have made a difference to any crime anywhere. But they were trying to get at this scripture right here. Are you faithful and taking care of something? Because we need to test it here, when in this controlled environment. We got to test it out so we know when you are in control of several thousand dollars that you're going to take it. You're going to put it in the evidence locker where it belongs. When you're in control of someone else's freedom, you're going to make the right decision. Things that matter. We got to test it out here. If you're faithful in the small things, then we can give you more. And it's no different with our spiritual life. You know, if we are willing to sacrifice the small things, to engage in a little conversation maybe with someone that no one else is going to find out about, you know, it's a reflection. God is watching. We take maybe a little bit extra. No one's going to know. No one's going to be affected by it. That company can absorb the loss. It harms no one. You know, those things, God is watching. If you are taking care when no one's looking and nothing matters, then you're taking care of when it all matters. Because it's not a it's not about the thing. It's about who you are. What decision that you're going to make. And David, you know, he was not perfect. He made mistakes. And you and I are probably going to make some mistakes down the road. Here's this picture, supposed to be of King David on a throne, and that's Nathan, the prophet. He's coming to talk to David. And if we remember this story, it's in 2 Samuel. David has taken Bathsheba and in secret has fornicated with her and sent her out. And then she realizes that she's pregnant by his hand with his child and notifies them. And so he tries to hide it. He brings her husband back from the war front to try and hide this pregnancy. Keep trying to keep everything secret. And his captain he brings back doesn't cooperate, won't sleep because his men are out in the field. I'm not going to sleep with my wife when my men are out in the field. It's dishonorable. So then he said he takes him and he puts him in the heat of the battle and is killed. So David fornicates and commits murder and does it all in secret. And the Lord lets Nathan know, okay, you've got to go deal with this. I cannot let this slide. It will give enemies cause against the house of Israel. And so Nathan tells him the story. You know, the parable of the rich man who has 100 sheep and his friends are coming to town. And so he doesn't want to sacrifice any of his sheep. So he goes to a man who has but one lamb and takes this man's one lamb so he can feed his friends. And when David hears this story, he demands the death of this man. Who is this man? He's going to die. But before he dies, he's going to pay back fourfold what he took. And then Nathan looks at him and says, "It's you. You are the man. You are the one who has done this evil thing. You've had wives aplenty. And you took one. It didn't belong to you." And David knows it. He knows that death is the answer to this. That his life is owed. And it hits him deeply. But David wasn't killed. Death was not given. You know, we can look at this point, this dot. We can say, you know, David, he got away with it. He didn't die as he was supposed to, as the law demanded, as David knew should happen. He didn't die. His life was not taken. Why not? Well, you go back to 1 Samuel in the 24th chapter, and we have the story. He is being pursued again, back in the hiding in caves. 1 Samuel 24, verse 4, and the men of David said unto him, Behold, the day of which the Lord said unto thee, Behold, I will deliver thine enemy into thine hand, that thou mayest do to him as it shall seem good unto thee. And so Saul, he found Saul sleeping on one occasion. Actually did it twice. Found him sleeping in a tent, I think, and found him sleeping in a cave one time. And each time, his men were like, here he is. He's been trying to murder you. He's been trying to chase you. He's been trying to destroy you. Take his life. You're justified. Then David arose and cut off the skirt of Saul's robe privily. And it came to pass afterward that David's heart smote him because he had cut off Saul's skirt. And he said unto his men, The Lord forbid that I should do this thing unto my master, the Lord's anointed, to stretch forth my hand against him, seeing he is the anointed of the Lord. He would have been justified in defending himself, but he chose mercy. He chose to grant mercy. God has put him on the throne. He's not going to leave the throne under my hand. I'm going to give mercy. And so mercy was granted by David. And so he received mercy. Matthew 5, 7, blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Is why his life was not required. You know, David did something else as well. If you go back into 2 Samuel chapter 12, Bathsheba gives birth to this child. And part of this, Nathan tells him, you know, this child is going to die. You know, this is one of the hardest scriptures that I find in the Bible. It's hard. But here it is. 2 Samuel 12, 13. And David said to Nathan, I have sinned against the Lord. And Nathan said to David, the Lord also hath put away thy sin. Thou shalt not die. You are going to receive the mercy which you were given, which you had given. Howbeit, because by this deed thou hast given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme, the child also that is born of thee shall surely die. You know, it's one of the most uncomfortable scriptures in the Bible. And it's one of those points that people take and they go, look, God is cruel. Takes the life of this child that had nothing to do with anything. And Nathan departed unto his house, and the Lord struck the child that Uriah's wife bare unto David, and it was very sick. David therefore besought the Lord for the child, and David fasted and went in and lay all night upon the earth. Like I said, this is one of the most difficult scriptures to read. And why would God do such a thing? Well, there's a couple different explanations. You know, that phrase, Lord struck the child, they often use that when people got sick. You know, it wasn't that the Lord struck down the child in his wrath, but that we live in a fallen world and children die. Especially back then, birth rates were much lower. But this child died. You know, the other reason is maybe we're supposed to be uncomfortable. Maybe we're not supposed to think on this story fondly. Maybe we're supposed to look on sin and its effects. And that sin, when we do it, affects other people. That sometimes we can sin so much or sin in such a way that we don't pay the price. But someone else does. Someone had nothing to do with it. Someone who was innocent. And David knew it. He fasted. He fasted so much, he laid himself down in sackcloth and ashes, and all his attendants thought, you know, he's going to die. And then the child passes away, and they're all afraid to tell him because they think that he's just going to go crazy. And the child dies. And he gets up, and he cleans himself off. You know, and it bothered David. He was remorseful. Just like sin should bother us, just like the death of the innocent should bother us, it bothered David. In Psalm 51, first verse, to the chief musician, a psalm of David, when Nathan the prophet came unto him after he had gone into Bathsheba. Have mercy upon me, O God, according to thy loving kindness. According unto the multitude of thy tender mercies, blot out my transgressions. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity. Cleanse me from my sin. For I acknowledge my transgression, and my sin is ever before me. Against thee, thee only, have I sinned and done this evil in thy sight, that thou mightest be justified when thou speakest, and be clear when thou judgest. You know, he begged for forgiveness. He came to the Lord, remorseful, penitent. Not placing the blame on anyone else, but begging his forgiveness. God was kind enough to send him a prophet, to bring to light what he'd done. Forgiveness was asked. Forgiveness was given. In Isaiah 55, verse 6, seek ye the Lord while he may be found. Call ye upon him while he is near. Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unrighteous man his thoughts, and let him return unto the Lord, and he will have mercy upon him. And to our God, for he will abundantly pardon. You know, this is what David received, huge pardon. He was given his life. Sin still had this effect. You know, from that moment on, his house, his kingdom was shaken. His other sons died. There was a civil war between him and one of his other sons. But his life was spared. Forgiveness was given. He still had to deal with the sin. He still had to overcome quite a bit in his later years because of his sin. And then the one thing that happens after that, kind of tie this story off, Solomon is born from Bathsheba. The next king is brought to fruition through this whole tragic event of a child is born. The next king of Israel, who was the wisest, who built the temple. So good can come even from something so terrible. Because God can see the picture. He can see all the dots. He knows all the connections. Even when we can't. You know, you look, if you're traveling down this road, you wouldn't be able to see where it's going. It's surrounded by forest and hills. And you don't know what's around the next corner. You don't know why you're facing what you face. You don't know why someone else is going through what they're going through. But you know, God has this view. He can see the path. He knows where you're going. He knows what is ahead of you. He can connect all the dots. He's connected all the dots. You know, God's view is something else. He looks for something different in each of us. 1 Samuel 16:7, when David was called to be king. But the Lord said unto Samuel, look not on his countenance or on the height of his stature, because I have refused him. Speaking of David's older brothers. For the Lord seeth not as a man seeth. For man looketh on the outward appearance, but the Lord looketh on the heart. Christ said so much the same. Matthew, the 23rd chapter, 25th verse. Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you make clean the outside of the cup and of the platter, but within they are full of extortion and excess. Thou blind Pharisee, cleanse first that which is within the cup and the platter, that the outside of them may be clean also. You know, God looks differently. The outward appearance, which we often look at, put a lot of stock into, you know, God looks different. Those little things, those little dots in your past, those small dots in your future, those points where you have to make a decision when nothing matters, when no one sees it, that is what God is looking at. At each of us, it doesn't really make sense always. You know, you can have someone who's completely successful, knows how to run a huge church or run, you know, whatever it is, a business. And yet on the inside, you know, they're torn up. Because God looks at things differently. 1 Corinthians 1:25, because the foolishness of God is wiser than men, and the weakness of God is stronger than men. For you see your calling, brethren, now that not many wise men after the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God hath chosen the foolish things of the world to confound the wise. God hath chosen the weak things of the world to confound the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised hath God chosen, yea, the things which are not, to bring to naught things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. You know, there's reason for this. We can't sit there and stand before God one day and look at what all I have done. I'm going to stand before him. Say, I see what you've done for me, Lord. Ether 5. And when I had said this, this is a Mormon, he's writing. He's worried about his writings. He's worried about his weakness. He's worried that people are going to mock and throw out the word of God. And when I had said this, the Lord spake unto me, saying, fools mock. But they shall mourn. My grace is sufficient for the meek, that they shall take no advantage of your weakness. If men come unto me, I will show them their weakness. I give unto men weakness that they may be humble. My grace is sufficient for all men that humble themselves before me. For if they humble themselves before me and have faith in me, then will I make weak things become strong unto them. Behold, I will show unto the Gentiles their weakness, and I will show unto them that faith, hope, and charity bringeth unto me the fountain of all righteousness. You know, everyone is weak or has weakness. Everyone has their point of contention. Everyone has their point where they're not strong, a chink in their armor. But humility, as David showed, as he was lamenting, he was able to save his life because he had saved the lives of others. And it's no different for us. We have to let go pride, be humble, acknowledge our sin, acknowledge our weakness before him. Because someday, we're going to get to the final point, the end of our life. Alma, chapter 9, verse 40. And we see that the death comes upon mankind. Yea, the death which has been spoken of by Amulek, which is the temporal death. Nevertheless, there was a space granted unto men in which he might repent. Therefore, this life became a probationary state, a time to prepare to meet God, a time to prepare for that endless state which has been spoken of by us, which is after the resurrection of the dead. You know, this final point, we're all going to get to that point at some time. Nobody gets out of life alive. It's got 100% death rate. So all those points, what picture are you drawing? What decisions have you made? Those high points, are you repeating those low points? Were they building? Were they forming? Have we learned from our failure? Have we replicated success? Because at some point, it will be the end, the final dot in our lives. So I hope that this evening, you're able to take what I've said today and realize that, you know, no single point is what makes up our lives, but it's many points, many decisions. And each one of them, God is watching and looking. And even if we do mess up, even if we do make mistakes, just as David was redeemed, we too can be restored. I thank you for your time.